Rockwell.
Well, Sean,
we have people in our apps, in our app, my app rather, that do not work for us.
I don't understand what you mean.
Meaning, the app has launched. Side door.
Oh, in your app is no longer in your hands. It has pushed it out of the nest, and is now flying free through the interwebs.
That's correct. Yep.
Into the hands of the unwashed masses.
The unwashed masses. It's been okay. So fun story. So I guess my topic for this week was everything's just broken, right? That's how I'm feeling. We'll get to more of that. So we use a company called Avalara, and I'm not trying to throw them under the bus, but we use a company called Avalara for a lot of different things. So like sales tax. So basically they keep track of the sales tax laws, because in the US it's like every county can even have different sales tax rules, right? So they do our sales tax calculations. We send them like, here's the origin, here's the destination, here is the shipping cost, here's what the things are, how much should we charge in sales tax? So they give us a number. So that's what we use them for. We also use them for tax exemption statuses and certificate verifications. So because designers are using our app, they get to purchase tax-free because they're reselling. They have a resale certificate, or they have to give us one in order to be able to sell something on from side door to a client. So Avalara also handles that. So it's pretty big, complicated software.
Wait, can you just explain that to me? So I never really thought about this, because being a reseller, what you're saying is you somehow get certified and you don't have to pay sales tax to basically buy from the manufacturer. Is that correct? You're getting at?
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
So sales tax moves on. Sales tax is always the burden of the end consumer.
Makes sense. Okay. Never really thought about it.
Yeah. So they get licenses, like a designer will have a license, granting them tax exemption status. And so they upload that and we verify it. And Avalara keeps track of that. So when the designer is going to purchase, we obviously know if they've given us a license, and we have Avalara, we have registered an exemption in Avalara for this user. And if an exemption exists, then Avalara says, okay, well, no taxes due here. You don't have to pay any sales tax here. So, we've been testing for a while with on our sandbox account, all good. I talked to our account rep, everything's good to go. You're good to go live. And in production, we tested sales tax calculations. Cool. That's fine. And then we get to try to like verify a certificate. Error.
Don't.
You know what the error was? So the error we got back was account not provisioned.
Okay.
It says, this error message indicates that the automatic provisioning process for exemption certificates failed. This error has been automatically reported for review. What that means is that when our account was getting set up, some sort of automatic provisioning failed, and I had to reach out to them, and they said, oh yeah, 48 hours. It might take us 48 hours to do this. And I was like, excuse me?
Good one job.
What do you mean 48 hours? Anyway, got that sorted. But that was fun. And that sort of kicked off my everything is broken. Like, what? That's such a strange like way to have a failure in a production API, like a live prod API. Like, oh, there's this thing that will never happen in development, but it could happen in production. And if it does happen in production, it could be up to 40. In fact, when I email our account rep, again, I'm not trying to drag them because they're a big company, right? They're going to be busier. It's like you kind of have all this red tape to go through whenever you're working with a bigger company. But, I email my account rep and it autoresponder could be up to 48 hours before you hear from me.
Cool. No problem. Just trying to run a business over here.
Yeah, getting past that, it's all right. But our invite process is pretty cool. So it's like a closed beta, but we have like 1,500 people on the list for the beta. So we've been using, our sales team has been using Intercom to kind of interact with these designers. And so people that sort of opt into the beta, they get a specific tag in Intercom. And then our Laravel app, every night it pulls a fresh list, or it updates that list of tagged users in Intercom. And then in the admin panel in our app, you can just click a user, click invite. They'll get the email. They'll get the welcome email. Like, here's our early access program, like instructions. Here's, what we're working on. Here's our roadmap. Here's what you can do now. Here's what we don't have yet. Here's where you can find the help articles. So our salesperson can just go into the app and say, oh yeah, I'm going to put this person in, clicked on, invited, message them in your comment. Hey, you know, like, let me know if you have any questions. It's like pretty easy process. I was pretty happy with how that worked out. And, you know, talking with Jackie about like having an invite process and things like that, like obviously he did a lot of the work to put that together, but I'm just really happy with how that process turned out.
Yeah, it sounds really cool. That can be a really friction heavy process to go through on any application, and to make that onboarding as simple as possible is always going to be a positive.
Yeah. So thankfully nothing too crazy was actually the other thing that I ran into was a sudden like slow down, like not slow, but like noticing that the product, cause we're on DigitalOcean, right? And we're using a managed Postgres database. And by default, they give you connection settings to just connect directly to the database. There's no connection pool in between. And by default, you have like up to 22 connections on the plan that we have. So yeah, I started to notice that some processes were holding on to connections for whatever reason, because I got occasional error messages saying like, hey, you know, we're out of connections or whatever, just like a generic backend error. So I started looking into it and I was like, oh, I should probably put a connection pool in front of this. That would make sense, right? We probably want to pool connections to it. And I slapped a connection pool in front of it and no more issues, no more like held connections, nothing.
Does Laravel not use a connection pool by default or what?
I don't know, honestly.
Wait, so you put some other application in the middle?
Well, so DigitalOcean has set up, basically when you create a managed database, you can just click a button and put a connection pool in front of it using pgbouncer. pgbouncer? Yeah.
Interesting.
So it was like three clicks. So you click to create it, you name it, then you tell it how many, what the number of max connections you want to allow. And they generally, they advise half of the available connections to your database, because if you let that max out, then yeah, you have more people connecting to your database, but that doesn't mean they're getting the responses faster.
Interesting. So your application could still be holding on to a connection. It thinks it's holding on to a connection for a long time, but really the connection pool is just kind of like putting in a queue somewhere and mm-hmm. using one of its actual mm-hmm. connections to the database. So it just will take longer instead of starving the number of connections. Is that the idea?
Yeah. Yeah. So the idea is that, like, I think one of the best analogies I read about this on some, I'll have to try to find it. I don't know if I will be able to, but basically it's like, okay, so you have eight people in line at McDonald's and there's one person working. You could let eight people order at once, but that doesn't mean the burgers are going to come faster. Yeah, throwing the connection pool in front of it seemed to help out quite a bit, and I haven't noticed any like spikes in used up connections or anything like that. So far so good. Like things are running smoothly. Like, you know, imported as of right now about 40,000 SKUs or like 40,000 products in the database right now. That's like seemingly okay. You know, like knocking on my table, but
that's cool. I'm really curious to see what, if you can find out what's actually holding onto those connections. If it's some kind of weird intricacy with the way Laravel or their Active Record thing, Eloquent, maybe Eloquent's doing something weird. I don't know.
Or it could be the queue, honestly. Like that's my hang up with Laravel is that there's so many moving pieces just out of the box. I'm not used to working with a cache because in DK, like we never had to cache anything and we cache the crap out of everything, especially product related. On our side. So that's another thing like to think about is like invalidating caches. If Lindsay's like curating products, like this looks bad or this is missing an image or these images are like out of order, then she has to edit it. But then if the cache doesn't invalidate, then she, you know, it's hard for her to keep track of what she's changed. And, but then if you invalidate all of the product cache on a single product change and she's updating products every 2 minutes, then you might as well not have a cache in that point. So yeah, there's that, but then there's also Redis, you know what I mean? And there's lots of different layers of indirection and the WebSocket server that runs alongside of it. And it's just a lot of moving pieces. DK was just Phoenix in a database.
Yeah.
The REPL is great. Tinker is really great. I've used Tinker a lot to like, we have a verification process for products that come in. So if a product gets imported, we verify the stock is right, the pricing is right, the images are good, all that stuff before it goes live. But because we had 40,000 to sort through, we just mass verified lots of products. So I just did that with Tinker. And then we go through and just scroll through and pick stuff out that shouldn't be in there. But yeah, Tinker is really great. Eloquent has so much magic in it. It's hard for me to even like it's really nice to use when you're trying to move quickly and just get stuff done. Like when you just launch an app and you have to fix something or change something, you don't have to be like, where Ecto, where you're sort of like basically writing SQL into the REPL to do something, or you don't have to like write a bunch of functions and then deploy them to use them, right? So an example of this is just a lot of, I think there's like a, I don't know what they're called exactly, but they're basically like shortcuts, right? So if you have, you know, product where name, comma, rock, like that'll find you all products where name, or where like rather, where names are like rocks. But you can actually do like where attribute name on a model. So if you're looking at a product, you can do where price paren. So that's actually like a method that you have access to, or where name, or where whatever. So if you're looking at an image, where path, where source, where, you know, so it's just like allows you to move around a little bit faster, which was really nice.
That's nice. Yeah. The amount of times, if I had a nickel for every time I went to the Rails console in production and was poking around at the database or trying to fix records that got, you know, do some mass updates for some things that got imported wrong, or just like just doing reports of like finding all users, you know, who signed up within a certain date range. Like, yeah, for a lot of those things, you know, try to build on admin dashboard for as many of those use cases as you can. But sometimes you just need a one-off. Yeah. You know, we need to add a bunch of emails to our mailing list, like, you know, just export that list and stuff like that. Or yeah, it's very, very powerful. And like you said, doing it with Ecto, you can do it obviously in production with Phoenix, but it's a lot more cumbersome versus just having an active record thing that you can just chain a bunch of methods together. And obviously you have to know what those magical methods are and how they work. But even today, so we're trying to reconcile sort of our accounts in our system with our accounts in FreshBooks, because we're beginning to find that things are basically getting out of sync, where we're basically in a situation where some people might be basically not paying for their service, right? Even though they're getting access. Yeah. Or people might be paying for a different service than they have. And so I had to just build a little table in our admin interface. It's just like, hey, like, here's all of our active users, grab all the information from FreshBooks, and then just basically cross-reference it all together so we can get all the stuff in one spot and figure out what to do about it. Like you mentioned before, about we're just doing it in the controller action. Like you mentioned that a few weeks ago when I was all got all in a tizzy, but like really it's just the best way to do it. It's just this one thing. It's very specific. It's the admin backend thing. It's basically throwaway. Do a bunch of active record in a controller action and make a single table view, and like it's gonna save the person who has to go through it, not me luckily, tons of time versus trying to like click through one person at a time and validate, you know, all of our hundreds of users.
Yeah.
So stuff like that is just, man, I mean, I haven't written really any true Rails in a long time, you know, on and off over the past few months. And every time I get in there and just it's like moving at the speed of light, man, it's so easy to love and so easy to also get way too far in the weeds and get out of control. But like, for example, when I was sorting my users list, I forgot I had a default scope on my users model, right? I didn't know any better, right? But like, there's no way I can take the default scope out now because it would break everything. So now whenever I do a query on my users table, I have to unscope it. It's just so dumb.
Yeah, there's so much to know about Eloquent, right? There's so many levels of it. It's so extensible too. It's pretty insane how extensible it is. You can do some wild stuff that's really bad for performance, but makes it really easy to do a lot of things really quickly. That's obvious. I guess I think that's the classic trade-off of a big ORM versus something smaller. But I suppose, like I should have mentioned last time when I was talking about, just do a lot of it in the controllers until you're able to extract it or make sense to pull it out. What I should have meant or should have said was, we have lots of small controllers. We don't have few big controllers, which makes it a lot easier. So, you know, there might be, if there's a function for like featuring a product or image for a product, we'll have a product featured image controller, you know, that might have, it's not a singleton, but it might have like one or two methods interactions in it. So that's been sort of really useful too, because it's like you get right to the point. It's not, you know, because once the controllers get bigger and you're trying to do some of that logic in the controllers to keep it simpler, then you start having all these little like private methods or functions in there. And then that's when it gets really confusing. But yeah, I've been able to jump in and, you know, just ship PRs, like fixes, like small enhancements. So basically the work split is Jackie's focusing on all things front end and UX. including the back end for the front end. And I'm focusing on all things admin and tooling for our inventory team, for the curation, like Lindsay curating and making sure things like the data is correct and all that stuff.
Sounds like a pretty good division of labor there.
I think it's working. I mean, he's really good at what he does. So.
I know it's not the most exciting for you.
I get satisfaction out of it though, because like, I know that like Lindsay or Chad or whoever else will just sit there and they'll click through hundreds of products to make sure things are correct or like make sure it's looking the way designer, because designers are looking at this a very specific way. I get satisfaction out of like, I know they're having a pain point or something is slow or frustrating for them. And if I can make something be not frustrating to me, that's really satisfying because I know how that feels when I build tools for myself like that. So it's okay. Like I don't mind it. Plus it helps me learn about Laravel, helps me learn about writing tests because I try to test everything that I'm writing and stuff. So, but yeah, like there's lots of layers, like, you know, there's lots of layers to Laravel. There's lots of moving pieces to Laravel, but like hunkering down and just getting stuff done, feels really, I don't know, just it's fine. Like it's good. I can feel productive at it, which makes me feel good. And I'm not in spreadsheets anymore. So,
well, there you go. Well, at the beginning, it sounded like the end of the world. Everything's broken, but
we'll get to that.
Oh, okay. We're still not there yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's cool. Congrats on launching the product. Everyone in the chat here is happy for you, as am I, and big milestone. And obviously it's still an uphill battle from this point, but hopefully you're getting some good feedback there too.
Yeah, now it's like the real work starts, keeping people happy. So the whole thing, like I spent a lot of time writing in Intercom, and a lot of what I was trying to write was from the lens of we don't want to build software that you're forced to use. We want to build software that you want to use, and so we want to build that software with you, alongside of you. So obviously there's work for us because we have to decide what makes sense and what doesn't, but that doesn't mean that we want to do that in a vacuum chamber and just build it and push it out there and miss the mark in that sense. So that's like a lot of the reasoning in my communication with designers has been is, hey, we want to work together with you to build this thing because there's a lot of designer software out there that it is what it is and you just have to use it. You have no sort of stake in what it actually is. It is what these other people making it want it to be. Whereas we want this to be a tool to help them speed things up, like solve some of those admin overhead problems so they can get back to designing because that's what they like doing. That's what they're good at, you know?
Yeah. Just doing the job isn't good enough for you.
Yeah. Yeah. So we want to do the job with them and alongside of them. So that's what I think like taking that lens or that approach actually has helped a lot. Like I think taking that approach with the designers, I think they can tell that we're not trying to, we don't have an angle. We're not trying to make money off of their backs, basically. So I think they can tell. I don't know. Like we've gotten good feedback from it so far. So from like that approach, anyway.
That's great to hear. I mean, it sounds like obviously it helps having Lindsay on your team too, because she's got the right idea and the right eye for what this product really should be, like from the beginning, right?
Yeah. Yeah, she is sort of the target market, but I guess to get to my topic of everything is broken and I'm mad at technology. It's all of my personal computers are haunted. I think that's what I'm coming away with.
Oh, we're not talking about the app now. We're talking about just your world of technology. Everything's broken.
Everything's haunted. Yeah.
So I'm looking at your stream and I see an iMac behind you. So that means that Jamie's iMac is, well, it's off. So I don't know if it's working, but I do see an iMac back there.
That is a an LG 5K display. So yeah, it's turned off. The iMac is fixed though. Yeah, I guess it starts with the iMac, okay? And Jamie, if you hear this, it's fine. But so Jamie's iMac bit the dust and we had to take it to Apple and it was either the power supply or the logic board.
It's pretty much the only two parts in the iMac and the screen.
Right. They replace the logic board, obviously the more expensive of the two parts. They send it back with us. So the problem was that it would just turn off and it wouldn't turn back on. And until seemingly randomly, it would just turn back on. So
it's a power saving feature, Sean.
We take it in, they replace the logic board, give it back to us. 3 days go by, same thing happens. It just turns off. Yeah. And so in talking to them, they're like, oh yeah, well, after we put the new logic board in, we didn't test the power supply. So we're like, okay, well, it could have been the power supply though all along. Jamie could have just paid for the more expensive logic board, and you didn't test it after you put the new logic board in it. So we take it back. We're at the Apple store. The Genius Bar representative is saying like, oh yeah, you probably just have to wipe this computer. It's probably software related because nothing's happening here. And as he's saying it, the computer shuts off and won't turn back on. He had her turn it on, and it turned on, and all her stuff turned on. He's like, oh yeah, Dropbox, that's like a pretty CPU intensive thing. And then he was talking about having to wipe it, and then it shut off. And then he's like, all right, let me look at it. He couldn't come back on. So we leave it there. California shuts down the malls, and the Apple store here is in a mall. So the mall's closed. And so while this is happening, you know, Jamie's been really busy. She has like zero experience with Windows. So I was like, hey, you can just use my MacBook Pro. You can use my laptop. We'll put you a user account on it. You can install Word, like everything you need on it. Because she has a 12-inch MacBook, the little ones. And that thing can't drive an external display and run Zoom and Slack at the same time. It just won't do it. Mm-hmm. And Word. So those are the three things that Jamie needs to work. Like Zoom, Slack, and Word. And she needs a big screen because she's reading and like cross-referencing and all this stuff. So anyway, she's using my laptop. I'm like, I got this PC here. I can work on it. So I started using the PC for, I don't know, like a week or week and a half or something. Fast forward, Jamie's iMac comes back. It's working. It's fixed. I get my laptop back. I'm like, okay, cool. I'm going to use it again. I start using my laptop. And at first I was like, oh, it feels like home. Like, mm-hmm. IntelliJ on a Mac just feels nice. It feels like I know everything. The keyboard shortcuts are there. It's what I'm used to. And then the Bluetooth stuff starts happening. So my devices just randomly disconnect, and I have to sit there and wait for them to connect again.
For reference, what OS are you running on that?
The newest one, not the beta.
Okay, but Mojave, I think.
Whatever the newest one is, I don't even know.
I've lost track at this point.
I don't even care anymore.
No, Mojave's last one. What are you? Catalina. We're on Catalina now.
Catalina. Yeah. So I'm running Catalina. My Bluetooth devices just randomly disconnect. My Logitech devices are super flaky on Mac OS. So like, I'll be scrolling fine, and then suddenly scrolling is super janky. I'll be typing fine, and suddenly typing is super janky. And then I start using the laptop itself. And of course, I have key repeating happening, all that stuff. I hate the keyboard anyway. Some keys are sticking. So I installed the software debouncer, and now I'm at like 6 keys that are being software debounced.
So behind you, I also see a laptop shaped hole in your wall.
Yeah, exactly. So I was like, screw it. I just went back to Windows. And so I've been using Windows, and it's mostly fine, except for this issue that I'm having where occasionally, so I use Windows S, and that launches the start menu, and it focuses on the start input, and you basically can use it to launch apps, right? So occasionally, I can't type into that input. I can focus it, but I can't type anything into it.
Yeah, you mentioned this last week, yeah.
Yeah, and then if I go into the system preferences, I can't type in that input either, and it turns out you can't type in. I can't type into Windows Terminal when that's happening either.
Oh my God.
Which, it's so, how does that even happen? So the only fix that I'm aware of is to just restart the computer.
Come on. That's been the Windows Ultimate fix since day one.
Yeah, I suppose. But it's new to me again after 10 years of Mac only. 12 years, I think. I was just mad because I had, I'm getting stuff done, and suddenly, like, I'd rather restart my computer than dig through the start menu, whatever. The start menu is garbage. I don't use it beyond the launcher. I'd rather use the launcher than dig through that. But, and there's another thing too, like Windows arrow keys, it has like window snapping built in, right? So you can move windows around. But I'm using two displays, and sometimes when I snap a window to the right, one or two pixels will overhang onto the next monitor.
Oh, that's infuriating.
Or when I go full screen, 3 or 4 pixels will be like hidden below so if you have Slack open full screen, when it says so-and-so is typing, that's cut off when I use the keyboard shortcuts to make it go full screen.
What about that new power toy? Isn't there like a power toy launcher that's similar to Alfred? Maybe you should use that instead of start menu.
It's very slow.
Oh, okay.
On my computer, it's very slow.
Well, it's still beta, right?
Yeah, it's still beta. So yeah, I'm just mad at my computers. I don't know that, because so you know, I put it on Twitter and no one responded to me, and I put it in Discord and people are like, you know, I don't really have that issue, so I think my computer's just haunted.
Just brings me back to my days of VB6 when I was like, I literally somewhere, I don't think I have it anymore, but I had a Win32 API book. It was like a good 3 inches thick soft cover, all about like the entire, you know, C++ interface into the Win32 API and how in Visual Basic there were ways you could get into that. It had interop with that. And so I got into this, like, I went down this crazy rabbit hole of like subclassing, learning how to subclass all the different OS components and like styling a text box so it had cool rounded corners and like buttons that looked like links and all this crazy custom stuff. And there were OS supported ways to sort of hook into the way that things were drawn, and then you could like get the handle to the drawing context and basically just paint your own control however you wanted, even though it was just still behaving like a system, you know, window, they called it, even though it was just a text box as a window. Man, it's the whole thing bringing back all these bad memories, but it sounds like something is misbehaving there, or something like hooked into it and then like didn't release the hook and is somehow, you know, basically hijacking how all text boxes work, something like that.
But it's only like system text boxes, I thought, and then the Windows terminal thing started happening, so that was even stranger.
That's weird. That is weird.
Yeah, I couldn't type. I was sitting there like, wait, what? What is it stuck? Like, is the, because I had an SSH shell open. And so I was like, what, did it like lose connection or something? And then I realized I opened another tab and I couldn't type, and then I got mad. And yeah, so that's where we're at, you know? So I'm thinking like, will even like reinstall, like will wiping my Mac make it any more reliable? Like it seems like obviously the keyboard's hardware. Bluetooth could be hardware related, could be software related, who knows? So maybe I just send it to Apple while I'm on my Windows kick right now. I don't know.
You know, Sean, I've been hearing, word spreading. 2020 is year of Linux on the desktop.
I've gone that route as recent as 6 months ago. And then I got a new graphics card and suddenly Linux didn't work, or my display wouldn't work, period, on Linux. So
yeah, integrated graphics is fine.
Oh, and then on top of that, my USB-C to DisplayPort cable is flaking out, so it has to be just right.
Oh my God.
Yes, everything's just breaking here, I think.
So I have a question.
Yeah.
Quick tangent. I just got a new graphics card as well, similar to what you got. It has a USB-C port on the back of it.
Mm-hmm.
Is it USB-C or is it Thunderbolt? Do you know?
USB-C.
It is just USB-C. Okay. Just interesting that they would include that on a graphics card, even though, I mean, my computer doesn't have USB-C, so it's nice to have at least one USB-C port. But like, I've got 8 or 10 USB 3.0, you know, A ports.
Yeah.
Just really weird inclusion there.
Yeah, it is. And that's another thing too, because like Jamie has one of these 5Ks and I have one of the 5K monitors as well. And I would love to use it on my PC, but my PC doesn't have, my motherboard doesn't have a Thunderbolt header. So that's, I think that was the big thing, like getting the PC and getting a graphics card, seeing, oh, there's a USB, like, all I know is it looks like a USB-C. I can just plug stuff into it, right? And then lo and behold, I'm like, oh, there's things called Fire, like what's it called? Thunderbolt. And there's non-Thunderbolt, there's just plain USB-C. Yeah, and then you go and get a motherboard thinking like, oh, it has USB-C on it, like it'll work with Thunderbolt thing, but no, it's not a Thunderbolt input, it's just USB-C input. And then you have to start looking for motherboards that have the USB-C or the Thunderbolt header on it, and those barely exist. In AMD land, of course, they're all over for Intel, but I don't have an Intel CPU. I just recently went through that whole rabbit hole, actually, of how do I make this work? But
all I just want is a mid-tier Mac tower with some cards that I can put in it. Like, is that so much to ask, Tim Cook?
That's what I want. That's all I want.
I mean, even if it's, you know, twice the price of a comparable PC, just give it to me. Just put it on my desk next to my also affordable 5K monitor that you're going to make for me. And I'll be happy as a clam.
I saw on Twitter Adam Wathen showing his desk setup. And he has a 16-inch MacBook Pro that's driving the new display. I can't remember what the HDR, XDR? The new Apple Cinema display.
The name's so bad. I'm going to watch you struggle.
The expensive one, right? And he was like, yeah, it seems to drive it fine. Yeah, that, I don't know. Like, even this machine that I have sitting right here, this is a 15-inch MacBook Pro. It's 6-core. It's got 6 cores in it. It's got the Radeon graphics card in it. And 16 gigs of RAM. And you would think that it would, like, pretty easily drive a 4K display and a 1080p display, not even two 4Ks. And it's, like, struggle city. So I don't know if it's just this machine or what. This has been, hands down, my least favorite Apple product I've ever owned. This machine right here that I'm holding in front of the camera for people that are watching.
Hot take from Sean Washbot.
It's been my least favorite Apple product that I've ever owned.
I'm really sorry to hear that, man.
Yeah.
I mean, you had nothing but complaints about it, so.
Yeah. So there we go. That's why everything just seems to be broken. Everything seems to be broken on my side of things, so.
Well, so do you have a plan going forward? Like, you're on the PC. It's mostly fine. You're just going to stick that out for a while? Are you in the market for a new Mac? Are you going to wait for ARM? Are you going to see what happens there?
I'm definitely waiting for ARM before I spend money on like expensive Apple laptop. I mean, like, I have everything I need for Windows. There's like those minor annoyances. So I can deal with Windows snapping because I'll just move it a pixel. I can deal with that. What I can't deal with are my peripherals just disconnecting, which I've had zero issues with anything wireless on my Windows tower. Not a single issue. So yeah, I will definitely wait for anything ARM related before Apple comes out. And I think I'll probably just stick it out with my PC. And it's not like I can really travel anywhere. I'm not going to coffee shops right now. You know, I'm not working outside. So, you know, the tower is fine. Like, I have my office and I'm actually trying to make my office feel more like a place I want to be. I think that was part of the issue before, is like, I didn't want to be there. So I'm trying to work on that a little bit, but I'll probably just stick it out with Windows and just see, like, honestly, like, yeah, there's things I miss. Like, I noticed that I really only text when I'm using iMessage on my laptop. I almost never text from my phone. And so, like, Greg and Jamie would be texting me, and I would not respond for, like, 2 days.
Well, you can set up your, you know, the iPad with the keyboard, right? You can set that right up next to you.
Yeah, I can, but that's also, I just don't do that.
But yeah, iMessage with the real keyboard is far superior experience.
Yeah. So yeah, I'll probably, I mean, like, WSL is not perfect. It's workable. And if you don't want to use WSL, there's always Docker. And with my desktop hardware, Docker's fine. I just give it as many resources. Like, it probably has more resources than it has access to on my MacBook Pro. That's probably what all I'm doing. If I get frustrated with WSL, I'll just spin up a Docker container and throw whatever I need in that container, just dev in that. You could even just use the VS Code remote plugin to remote dev from a Docker container running on your computer, and you have a completely isolated environment.
How cool would it be if you had a motherboard that had a beefy, you know, Intel x86 CPU, and then also like a moderately budgeted ARM processor run alongside it? And then you just like literally have two OSs running simultaneously. You could just
That'd
like
cool.
seamlessly KVM between them with motherboard support. And
that'd be awesome.
That would be something, huh?
I've seen Linus Tech Tips do like dual CPU builds in one machine. The box was gigantic. It looked like a furniture box, but they did something ridiculous though. It was like multiple machines in one box. So like multiple GPUs. So no, they weren't obviously sharing the same hardware, but.
Oh, okay.
I guess one thing I did forget before thinking about VS Code Remote is that I was having this really strange bug where in VS Code, I shared a GIF of it earlier in the Discord, but I'd be typing and suddenly my cursor would jump back somewhere previously in a line, and it was driving me insane. Turns out it was the editor config plugin.
Oh, weird.
Yeah, so yeah, beware anybody that's using the VS Code editor, using the editor... editor config plugin, it could jack up your cursor. Again, everything is broken. And obviously, I prefer using JetBrains stuff, but for right now, I'm going to keep using VS Code, especially on Windows, because it's just a little bit more seamless. With every release, JetBrains is getting better. So like now you can actually point, like the node interpreter, you can point it to a remote source like WSL or somewhere else. And so when you run commands or it does IntelliSense, it'll run the commands on that interpreter or PHP or whatever. But there's still a little bit of friction there. So I'll probably just keep using Windows and VS Code for a while.
Okay. Sounds like a solid plan. And yeah. Plus it allows you to duck in and play a few rounds of Call of Duty in the middle of the day when nothing's going on, right?
When it's compiling, right?
Yeah, it's compiling.
Yeah. 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 I mean, there's that too. Also, I've noticed though, like when I do want to jump in and play games though, if like I'm trying to be competitive, I'll notice that sometimes I need to restart my computer because like I won't get as many frames as I normally would. Again, that's a minor annoyance for playing games, but I think that's what I'll probably keep doing. Like, I'm more comfortable on it now. It doesn't require me to buy anything right now. It doesn't require me to change anything major about my setup. Like, I guess like getting a new Mac right now also sort of irresponsible is not the right term. It's not the right term. It feels maybe it's not the right time, right? With ARM coming out, like it seems like that's going to be a huge win for Apple, especially with performance and stuff. So why wouldn't I wait for that?
Absolutely. And the question is like which models they'll come out with first, you know, whether they'll be the laptops. I'm guessing they probably will be because that's where you're going to see the biggest performance and, you know, power saving improvements. So I assume, but who knows, it's going to be the Pro versus like a 12 inch or a 13 inch, right? It might not be the computer that you actually want to get. I mean, I'm sure you want to get another aircraft carrier, right? Like probably go the 16 inch route.
I would probably do that route. Yeah. And probably something a little bit thicker, hopefully. So that way there's better thermals and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a big problem with mine now. And it's not like I make sure it's clean and I use air to like make sure the dust is outside of it, but it gets hot. And then I think that's really the issue, or it could be a lot of the performance issues that I'm having is thermal throttling.
Yeah. I've been working through some of this, data import stuff in Elixir, and, it only takes a few minutes to run, but it does peg the CPU at 16 threads on, I don't know if it's actually 8 cores or 16 cores, I forget now, but anyway, 1600% CPU, I have to take it off my lap. It's literally too hot to, like, it's uncomfortable.
Yeah, mine gets to boiling temperature, 220 degrees. Remember I was doing that stream and someone was like, your laptop's boiling. But yeah, my PC's sitting over here, it's got some fans in it, it's nice and cool, you know, I don't know, Yeah, I guess like that's interesting now than thinking about it. Like WSL2, obviously, I've had a few issues here and there. Why don't I try spinning up Docker and putting, you know, like have an Elixir VM, like an Elixir Docker container and a PHP Docker container, and just connect to it via VS Code, because you still get all of the plugins, you still get all the IntelliSense, you still get all the linting, you know, and then you don't have to worry about, I guess networking maybe, is. Maybe that's not even a concern though, because like WSL broke mine one time, you know, I wasn't able to like the WSL container couldn't talk to the outside world at one time. Remember? So maybe I should try that.
Yeah. It's probably more battle tested than WSL2 is at this point.
Right. Yeah. And then I can just install whatever Alpine Linux container and just put stuff, or Ubuntu, and just put stuff on it directly. I think that'd probably be fine. I don't do anything crazy for my shells. I don't have all these aliases set up. I use things pretty vanilla, honestly. So I think it could probably be a good fit.
And what have you been doing the Unity dev in?
Windows.
Are you using VSVisualStudio.net?
No, use Rider, JetBrains Rider.
Okay, another JetBrains thing.
It's really good. It's really good.
I can't imagine using anything besides Visual Studio for that, but to each their own.
I got Paul on the ropes. He was watching the stream on Saturday, and he was like, that looks really good. I might have to try it. And I was like, oh. Last thing I showed Paul that he liked was Vue.
Take all the credit, why don't you?
But no, I use Rider for that. Rider has a lot of cool, I mean, granted, I haven't really used Visual Studio, but Rider has a lot of nice stuff just out of the box. So I was just writing this crap code and it was saying like, oh, this is an expensive call, this is an expensive method, this is an expensive thing, you should do this instead, or you should avoid doing that. And it has all these sort of like extra linters built into it, which I thought was really nice.
So Kevin in the chat brings up an interesting point. He says that Docker now runs on the WSL2 kernel instead of Hyper-V, which I hear is much better, /shrug. So that's interesting, because that does sound better, but also you're still leaning on WSL2 at that point, which, if that's being problematic for you, then Docker on WSL2 maybe maybe is just another layer of abstraction that, you know, maybe that doesn't get you anything.
Yeah, and to be fair, it has been mostly paper cuts except for the one time it nuked itself. That wasn't a paper cut. But yeah, to be fair, it's been mostly small things. And also some of those paper cuts are just that it's not like, so for example, Laravel development, Valet is great. Valet is really nice on Mac OS, you know? So you just park it in a directory, in any folder in that, you can just access it via your URL without doing localhost or starting a server or anything. It's super handy. So now I'm just like, I have to start a Laravel server. I have to start Horizon by hand. Like, you know, what year is it? Which is so dumb because it's like I hit up and enter to start the server anyway. So because of the command history for that terminal. But yeah, it's like, it's not, you know, Windows dev with WSL isn't terrible. Like if you're happy with VS Code, if you're happy with that ecosystem, then it's fine. Like you can be happy and be productive.
Cool. Well, keep pushing through and we'll see what the end of the year reveals to us.
We'll see what those fancy new devices look like. I want to redesign from the outside in.
You want a MacBook with like a rainbow LED keyboard pulsing at you and maybe some like underbody lighting?
I don't take it that far. I don't like a lot of the LEDs and all that stuff in the PC world.
Maybe a big water cooling unit with a evaporator or radiator sitting on the desk next to you and tubes coming into it, steampunk style.
Yeah, I don't know. My desk is starting to become more, there's just more black things on it. I have a black Logitech, like, full desk mouse pad now, black Logitech keyboard, black Logitech mouse. My computer case is black with a glass pane on the side. It's starting to get a theme going.
Black is the new black, man.
Oh, I guess I did have a bit of good news, though. I passed my React code test.
Hey, that's awesome. Congrats. Yeah. I mean, it's React, but congrats.
Yeah. That was round one. Next is round two of unknown number of rounds. So
one of N. Well, I got a little bit of follow-up from last week's discussion about XML parsing.
Ooh, let's hear that.
I know everyone's waiting for this. I wish I could remember who mentioned this in the chat. I mentioned I've been bulk importing thousands of XML files into Postgres, and I've been using Sweet XML because that's what I've always used, and it works fine, and it does what I need to do, and it actually has pretty nice syntax, has nice sigils for doing XPath. You know, being able to just like manipulate and go through the documents and the elements and stuff has been pretty nice, and how it worked how I expected it to. Someone recommended Saxy, which is completely different type of parser, obviously. It's a Sax parser, which is like a style of parser where basically it's the parser's parser. Like you literally provide a bunch of callback functions and you get to handle every single open tag, every attribute, every piece of content, every closed tag, and it's up to you, you know, to it's basically as it streams through the data to accumulate that however you want to. And it's up to you to keep track of the DOM and what elements you want to keep and so on and so forth. So it gives you extreme flexibility to like process the data however you want and deal with exceptions as they come up. Obviously, improved memory performance because you're literally streaming the data through like one element at a time instead of loading the whole document to memory and then trying to parse it and then trying to like query it, right? That obviously doesn't work for large XML documents. And it also gives you performance because of all those things I just mentioned, you know, just raw performance because you don't need to sort of analyze the document in a way that you're not going to use it if you don't care, right? So Saxy parser requires a little bit more work. They do have a cool thing. I didn't want to implement all those callback methods because it's a very small document. I can load it all in memory. It's fine. Saxy supports this thing called the simple form, which is like, I guess that's an Erlang-ism, but basically it represents the XML document almost as like an abstract syntax tree where it's just a bunch of nested tuples and lists and strings.
Okay.
Right. There's no structs. There's no structure to it besides like, again, just nested types, basic types. And again, there's no way to query it. You have to basically dig through it by hand, either with recursion or just, you know, pattern matching or whatever to pull out the elements that you need to. And so I did that. So I loaded the documents. I create the simple form thing. Again, the documents are small enough that that's fine. And then I wrote a couple functions to just go through and pull out the records that I needed. Make a long story short, it was able to greatly improve my import time. So basically, it sped it up between 2 and 3x. So I'm parsing about 7,000 documents, importing 1.2 million records into the database, and went from like 2 minutes to under a minute.
Wow.
Import time.
That's great.
Which like, this is kind of a premature optimization. This is an import you literally run only once every 3 months, and you do it once and it's done. So it really doesn't matter, but it sure speeds up the development process, you know? And what actually happened was, when I was using SweetXML, I would run my parser or run my import process, and Elixir would use about 90% of the available CPU, and Postgres would be like the other 10%, because there's a lot of indexing going on with the insertion, right?
Right.
Postgres is busy, but you're still CPU bound by the Elixir application. When I used Saxy, Elixir was so blazingly fast that Postgres couldn't keep up. Like,
really?
Postgres actually became the limiting factor. Like, it was about 50-50. So I'd have 800% CPU Elixir, the Beam, and 800% Postgres, because those inserts were coming so quickly. And, you know, it's doing 16 concurrently at a time. So using 16 connections, and Postgres is indexing on insert. Yeah, that made for a spicy laptop, let me tell you. So I benchmarked it. If I took the DB inserts out, Saxy, you know, take out that limiting factor, Saxy ended up being about 4 times faster than using SweetXML. So again, not a huge improvement, but it was an interesting thought experiment. And now I kind of have that tool in my tool belt to you know, leverage that in the future. Now that I understand how it works, and it was not for nothing. So again, doesn't really matter in production, because it's a thing that runs so infrequently, it doesn't matter. But when I'm making lots of small tweaks to this import process, it sure makes rerunning the imports much faster.
Yeah, 4x. That's great.
Yeah, it's nothing to sneeze at. And this is on my MacBook. I don't know. I haven't tried it on my iMac yet to see if the performance is any better. Probably constrained by heat.
Right, right. I haven't looked at Elixir in a while, and every time I look at Elixir, it's so practical. Right, so I'm looking at this. I guess somewhere in the README it says it's pronounced saucy. Yeah, saucy, saucy. But anyway, I'm looking at it, and it's just like Elixir just seems so practical. It's like you're defining like how you should handle what you're giving it. Right, that's all there is. There's no extra baggage. There's no extra overhead there. It's just. You see it all right there. I guess I'm so used to with Laravel, which is totally different, like different tool, right? But I'm so used to like looking deep, if that makes sense, like having to look through levels.
Mm-hmm. And this is more just like one, take the problem that's presented in front of you and solve that small problem first.
Yes.
As opposed to trying to look at the big picture all at once.
Exactly. Yeah. And even with, you know, pattern matching, the way that, you know, start document, end document, start element, it's all very clear. Like, 'cause this function only deals with, you know, starting a document or ending a document or an element or ending an element. That's really nice.
Green Jenny in the chat says, just use a regex. I believe they're referencing a famous Stack Overflow post about how it is impossible to use the regex to parse HTML. Don't ever try it.
I wouldn't want to. Regex.
It's impossible.
Anytime I cannot use it, I won't use it. So, I mean, Cloudflare, you know, they recently had an issue that affected us because we use Cloudflare. But I remember that the time before this last outage, the outage was caused by a mistake in a regex that was pushed.
Yeah, it was a really, really subtle one too that you would only ever find in production with the way, yeah, it was some specific feature of regex called like reverse look ahead or something. I forget.
I just found it. This article was posted on July 12th, 2019.
The article is really, really well written. Yeah. Really breaks it down. We'll put a link in the show notes.
I just did. This stuff just scares me. So anytime I cannot use a regex, then I just don't use it.
Ah, so much fun though.
Yeah, maybe. So much fun breaking, like trying to figure out why something broke.
Well, yeah. Well, I appreciate the feedback. The real-time feedback did actually come to fruition. So that's awesome. And thank you guys for providing that feedback. That is valuable. So I hope you learned something too. I had one other little piece of follow-up sort of from several episodes ago when we were talking about Notion and Second Brain and all this stuff and going deep, taking a deep dive and putting everything in there. And it's still all been great, but particularly one of the things we did for our business was migrate our knowledge base, our support system, to Notion. The current system we had was like based off of WordPress, and it looked really crappy, and it was out of date, and it was hard to update. And we love WordPress. That's an overloaded term. We use WordPress for our marketing site, and it's fine. We use WordPress Engine. Shout out to them; they're awesome. But yeah, I just wanted something more modern that was easier to update. And so finally, we just decided this week, like, okay, let's just put it live, and we'll just improve it. You know, just add to it and tweak it over time. And so we did. I set up a redirect on so I have a custom domain support.remotehamradio.com, just a hard redirect to the Notion public page, because that URL is an abomination with a UUID in it, so I can't share that. But
right.
support.remotehamradio.com, quite a bit easier. And sometimes when I just have like a few minutes here and there, I'll just click around to it, do a little, you know, gardening, if you will. Fix typos and add things and replace things and just kind of improve it slowly, and just being able to get in and get out and make those changes without having to like commit and preview and publish and go through all the steps. It's all just right there. Yeah, sure. Someone looking at the page is going to be really confused when the text starts changing out from under them. But I think our user base is small enough that that's not going to happen ever. So that's been cool.
Yeah, I guess tending to a garden is you probably, if you enjoy it and there's less friction in doing so, you probably end up doing it more.
Yeah, I think it's a benefit to all, right?
Yeah.
That was the main impetus for making that push. And I think it will pay off. You know, it is pretty sparse right now. You can check it out. Like I said, support.remotehamradio.com. You can see how we're doing it. Lots of coming soons and, under construction sort of emoji in there. Like, hey, this is still a work in progress. But again, already better than what we had. Built in search, obviously, because Notion has search, so that's done. It's just so great. For example, just something as stupid as putting an image in the thing. Like, doing it with a CMS is always such a hassle, especially with WordPress. You got to upload it and then link it and keep track of it. And if you delete it, you got to remember to delete it from the server. And just, it's just, man, sometimes you got to like host it somewhere. With Notion, take a screenshot, paste it in there. You're done. Add a caption, you know. I've been using this app called GIFOX, G-I-F-O-X. Just a little screen recording thing. Select a portion of your screen, record, stop recording, creates a GIF, drag it right from there into Notion, and you're done. And like, that's just for these little support things where you've got lots of steps. Sometimes a screenshot is not really enough. You know, if you got a screenshot, you have to like draw arrows or put circles or some way to like delineate. Yeah. Hey, this is the thing you have to pay attention to. But a short animation is just usually way more instructive. You don't want to go and make a whole video for every sort of little support issue that you want to have, because they're going to get out of date quickly and they're hard to, you know, edit and takes a long time to produce. Written text is good. Little animation, really, really effective. It gets you 90% of the way there, and it just makes it way easier to update and stuff. So
yeah,
that's what's been working well for me. And I do get enjoyment out of just going in there and finding the holes in the documentation and just writing a little stuff here and there. And I'm going to start getting the habit where whenever I answer support ticket, before I answer the support ticket, I'm going to go to the knowledge base, write the answer in the knowledge base, and then like link the person to that page.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right. Right. Cause otherwise you just end up typing the same thing over 15 times. It happened today. Someone asked, oh, my CPU stuttering when I use the app. And I'm like, well, try these steps 1, 2, and 3. And I was like, wait, stop. Go to Notion, write out the steps, make little animations for them, and, you know, there you go. Now that's saved time in the future and hopefully saved a headache and maybe a support ticket in the future. So
that's a great approach. I try to do that with development too. If I end up, especially if I'm in a REPL a lot, if I end up doing something more than once, I have a scratch document in Notion where I paste snippets. So I have a bunch of them for DK for various things I might have to do in a REPL going back like 2 years. And so now I'm starting to accumulate my Laravel REPL snippets as well. But yeah, instead of just doing the thing, I think about, am I going to have to do this again? And if I'm going to have to do it again more than twice, then I just paste it into a Notion doc. And we're using Intercom for support. We do the same thing. So if I start to notice a couple of people asking Chad the same question, I'll just go write a help article. And then Chad can autocomplete or like share that help article right in the chat.
I had a thought today, like I should just start a public Notion. Just like a brain dump, you know, not stuff I care about privately for managing life stuff, but why not just make a page that, like, who cares? It's not for anybody, but why, like, sequester that knowledge in your own little database when you could just literally one click put it out there and maybe someone can peruse through it sometime and get something out of it?
I have that actually, or something similar to it. I basically in my Notion, I have a resources section, which is a database. And it has like things that I've clipped. It has sites that I found interesting. It has notes that I've taken on like learning Go. I have a bunch of notes on Go in it. I have some notes on like Laravel Livewire, how to be a product manager, React notes. Yeah. And it's like just shared to the web. You know, I don't allow editing, but people can comment if they want, I guess. But it just has a bunch of crap in it.
So Kevin in the chat brought up a really interesting use case too. He says he uses Notion for release notes for one of his projects, which is also an awesome use of that because it's like, it's basically a blog at that point, right? But it's more like a reference. I mean, he has a little database with all his little releases in it. And he's got a little bug emoji for bug fix releases, which is cute. Screenshots, of course, galore. This is great. Such a good medium for this. I mean, you could use GitHub releases, but like for a non-developer, who's gonna go to the GitHub thing, go to releases page, scroll through the tags and stuff? No one's gonna do that,
right?
And plus this allows you to tailor it for the end user as opposed to a developer, right? So I've actually been doing that as well internally. Is, you know, I obviously git commit, you know, try to write good commit messages all the time, but at a higher level, I write release notes for all of our application versions or for our five applications that we keep track of: Rails, Phoenix, Ruby, Vue/Nuxt.
Mm.
I guess there's only four right now. Oh, and Electron, that's five. So like, I got to keep track of all that stuff.
Yeah, it's like a personal knowledge base of things you've learned and knowledge you've accumulated.
It's funny about the release notes thing, because that was the first thing. As soon as we put up the knowledge base, I get a message in Slack. Hey, can we put the release notes in the console for the software versions? It's like, yeah, it's just, I guess so. We just embed it and like you're done, right?
Yeah, that's really cool. I'm glad that's working out. I don't love like writing in Intercom because it is just sort of a limited CMS, just like every other one. But
yeah, exactly. Every CMS is its own pile of garbage, seems like.
Yeah, yeah. And Notion does a good job of being like flex. I think they do a good job of just being sort of like flexible, but also approachable in that you would expect if you want to upload an image, you can just drop an image onto it, like you said. You don't have to like, where's the image upload tool? Okay, what can I upload? What can I not upload? I can't upload videos to this. I have to use this other thing over there to upload a video or drop a video onto it. I love how Notion, you just drop a thing on it and it stores it. You know, as long as you got space on your account, it just stores it.
I would pay money to remove the Notion branding. Just throwing that out there.
Yeah, maybe. I think I'd probably be more inclined to use it. I guess really the reason why we're using Intercom for our knowledge base is because as you're responding to someone, it can auto suggest articles in your knowledge base.
So that is cool.
Then you can click on it and send it. That's literally the only reason why. But I do need to get, I do use Notion a lot, but I need to get back into the habit of like putting more stuff in my resources database here.
I love now that they've also added the ability to, instead of just using an emoji, you can upload images for icons for things. So again, for the knowledge base, that makes it really, really valuable because I can use the literal icons for the specific like applications we have to support. Makes it really obvious when you're looking at it what you're actually clicking on.
Yeah.
So little things like that. Little formatting things, using dividers wisely, using white space wisely, consistent formatting. Lots of like little tricks just add up to make it for, you know, yeah, it is a general purpose tool that does everything, but with a little bit of work, you can get it to be very serviceable.
Yeah. Well, if your stuff is broken too, I want to hear about it because it makes me feel better about my stuff being broken. So
we can all be broken together. Are you broken on the inside, Sean? Do you want to talk about that too?
No, just my devices are broken. You stay out of my head.
Just wait until you get your neural implants and those start breaking. Then you'll have some issues.
Yeah, what's that guy doing over there? Oh, it's probably shorting out some sort of issue with his implant. There's an update. Update didn't install properly. Oh, he bricked his brain device.
Bricked his firmware.
Oh, no.
His wetware. You can tweet us pictures of your broken stuff at DNCcast on Twitter. Sean is Sean Washbot. Look for pictures of Watson, I assume. He's not broken. Maybe his brain's broken a little bit.
He's broken when he gets to the dog park for the first few minutes. His legs just go, yeah.
And on Twitter, I am Shrockwell.
Everything we talked about today is going to be in the show notes. So if you're interested in those links, head on over to dnc.show and the show notes will be there.
You can also be a part of the show and watch us stream live on Twitch, twitch.tv/dnccast. We record Thursday nights, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. And come hang out in the chat. We hang out a little bit before, a little bit after. It's cool. It's great. It's been great feedback for us. It's cool to have people be part of the show. And again, like, using the Saxy parser, wouldn't have gotten that probably feedback ever if I just mentioned it on the show and just went out to the ether. But someone brought it up, implemented it, made my development day better. So
it's awesome.
Come help us out. twitch.tv/dnccast.
Yeah, it's feeling like a little community now, whereas before it just felt like the podcast is just going out into the world. Like we're just setting it into space, you know? Just like the Tesla, it's just going. It's never coming back.
Well, no, it's coming back.
Well, it's never coming back to Earth. It's coming back this general direction. But yeah, the Twitch stream has been great because it feels like an actual community. People chatting, people learning together, people sharing information. Sharing feedback, you know, that's why the show was originally started, and it feels really, really great. So yeah, shout out to everybody in the chat that shows up week after week. We appreciate all of you, and you're all the reason why we continue to do this week over week. So, and I guess the last but not least, thanks to Spec for putting us out there and making this possible. You know, when we started the show, you know, he sent Bryn a little demo and he said, let's do it. And so he sort of made this possible for us. And so, you know, I've been thinking like most of my adult friends that I have right now are as a direct result of the podcast. The people I talk to every day, day in and day out, people I ask for advice, people I give advice to, it's all because of the show. So that wouldn't be possible without Spec. So thanks Spec. And if you're interested in other design and development related shows, head on over to spec.fm and check them out.
Well, all right, man. Grab some duct tape and fix things up over there. A little WD-40, a little duct tape. Your MacBook would be good as new.
Yeah, maybe the answer is just I'll just crawl inside of the VM, like inside of Docker, and that'll be my development world. Maybe that's the answer.
Well, let us know.
I will.
All right. Good luck.